Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host, and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. Except this week, we are not joined by a guest. We are bringing you some of your extra Patreon content paid for by our kind donors on patreon.com. The third foot, where we go back and look at an old topic in some detail, or we visit an old friend of the podcast, and that's exactly what we're going to do this week, because Ben, this week I thought it's about time we looked a bit closer at the life and times of Pliny the Elder.
Oh my god, I can't believe it's taken this long.
Friend of the show, Pliny the Elder. He's been popping up on the podcast for a long, long time, as I think he does on any trivia-based program or podcast.
Yeah. He's one of those people who turn up on shows like this and history shows where when you hear the name Pliny the Elder, it has a certain authority to it that suggests that what you're going to get is pearls of wisdom handed down through the ages. But more often than not, what you get is a dodgy oyster that has you vomiting into the toilet the next day. But I sort of feel like Pliny the Elder is a trade secret that classical historians have just kept around for a giggle.
Well, he very much... is useful in, like, we'll talk in detail about him, but basically his book his encyclopedia Natural History, which is in 37 volumes, I think, was the authoritative document on the ancient world for about 1500 years. It wasn't until maybe the 1400s that there's a copy of it from the 1400s, which is basically annotated in the margins, where it's some monk or somebody is correcting all the mistakes in it.
Well, do you reckon, because I just read a brilliant book all about medieval medicine, called Medieval Bodies, by I think he's called Jack Harknett, which I thoroughly recommend. And it's one of those ones where you look back at the medieval age and go, oh, you silly medieval geese, thinking all these things about the body and the four humours. But if you approach it with the mindset and context of someone from medieval times, a lot more of it begins to make sense. So I wonder whether the monk who looked at Pliny the Elder in that manuscript, actually, if you look back at the crazy bullshit Pliny was saying, it actually made it a bit more sense at the time.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case for a lot of the stuff. And then he has a habit of getting things a bit right and then going a bit too far with his ideas about the right thing he has just said, as we might talk about later on.
Haven't we all, Barry, got things a bit right and then got a little bit carried away?
Well, Pliny the Elder was born around AD 23 and lived till AD 79. His death in itself is quite an interesting story, which we'll come to a bit later on. And he was an author and a naturalist and a natural philosopher, but he also served in the Navy and in the Army. He was a close friend of the Emperor Vespasian, which was he sort of managed to raise to quite illustrious positions within provincial government under Vespasian as well. He's such a well-regarded figure that his nephew, who's Pliny the Younger, so he adopted his nephew. He didn't have any children of his own, so he adopted his nephew, Pliny the Younger. And Pliny the Younger wrote to Tacitus, who's also a very famous Roman historian, saying, "For my part, I deem those blessed to whom, by favour of the gods, it has been granted either to do what is worth writing of, or to write what is worth reading. Above measure blessed those on whom both gifts have been conferred. In the latter number will be my uncle, by virtue of his own and of your compositions." So he says that it's great to be someone who gets to write about great things or who is written about. And Pliny the Elder, in Pliny the Younger's view, is one of the people who both those things is true of.
How convenient.
Yes. To be fair, Tacitus basically used Pliny the Elder's history of the Roman wars with Germany as his main source for his own histories. Obviously, a lot of the people back then don't really know much about their family. He seems to have come from a fairly well-off family. He studied law, but he went off to join the army and fought lengthy campaigns in the Rhine region. And apparently it was while he was there that he wrote his first book, a book about the use of missiles on horseback. with the rather tickling title De Jaculatione Equestri, which sounds like about horse spunk, but it's not. Because that's what a jaculo means, is to, you know, throw out. So yes, he basically wrote about, you know, how to throw spears off the back of horses and how to use catapults and things like that while sitting on horseback. And
we all know the horse trebuchet was one of the most feared weapons.
But apparently it was quite a skill to be able to use the movements of the horse to assist in your throwing while sitting on the back of it.
Oh, to gain more momentum.
Yeah, yeah, apparently so.
I tell you what, dressage in Roman times is brutal.
Oh, javelin today would be so much more interesting if it was on horseback.
Yeah, if Jan Zalesny was galloping up to the white line on a Czech charger.
And he's been overtaken by Steve Backley.
Yeah.
So he was a soldier on a campaign. So he was writing his book, like, around the campfire in the camp while in his winter quarters, maybe when he had a bit more time. But yeah, he was, you know, part soldier who, in his spare time, was also writing works of nonfiction.
It's great. It's like when Johnny Cash was on detail in Germany and wrote I Walk the Line.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's the same sort of thing. He witnessed he was certainly around during the Great Fire of London, and he recounts seeing Nero.
Excuse me, he was around during the Great Fire of London?
The other Great Fire.
The other Great Fire. Sure, now it all comes out. Pliny the Elder was a time traveller.
No, he was 1600 years old is what he was.
Sorry. I mean, that's the sort of thing that he himself would believe.
And to prove it, he cut an arm off so he could count the rings.
Yeah.
No, he was around during the fire in Rome, the one during which Nero is meant to have fiddled. And he saw the building of the Domus Aurea, the Golden House, which was the extravagant palace that Nero tried to build in the area cleared by the fire. But he tried to keep a low profile under Nero's reign because he wasn't, you know, obviously Nero, touchy guy, but also apparently his family wasn't particularly in favour with the ruling family at the time. But once Vespasian came to power, he began to raise through the ranks, as I say. He was spent some time in Africa as a procurator, who was sort of a provincial governor figure. He went to northern Spain and then to Belgium as well. So he got to gather some of the stuff that he writes most authoritatively on in the natural history is stuff like mining technology, which he would have witnessed in the gold mines in northern Spain, or farming techniques from Belgium because he was there at the time, and poisonous toads in North Africa.
It is his eclecticism that makes him so engaging.
Absolutely. You look at his natural history. So I said it's 37 volumes. Volume 1 is basically the index. And I think the index is something like 70 pages long. Yeah, table of contents, which in English is 70 pages long. Volume 2 covers cosmology and astronomy. Volume 3 through 6 is geography. Volume 7 through 11 is zoology. 12 through 19 is botany. 20 through 32 is drugs and medicine. You can get a taste of what he was into if you go listen to our World's Worst Doctor episode with Keir Shields. And volumes 33 through 37 are rocks, metals and precious stones. And apparently, according to his nephew again, he had an extraordinary work ethic. He would get up about midnight to start working. When he was resting, when he wasn't working, he'd insist on having someone read a book to him. So he was still taking in information.
Feels very modern. Like, I feel like obviously some of the information that we take in when we're scrolling through Twitter or looking at YouTube all the time is angry nonsense, gossip and pap. But I think you and me and probably a lot of the listeners, we've got what I describe as a Johnny Five from Short Circuit brain, where we need constant input. And if you are not of the vintage to get that reference, don't watch the movie. It's very bad. And I think, as we've talked about before, possibly has some quite dodgy racist caricatures in it now. It was the early 90s. It was a different time. But I don't know why I've gone so off piece here. The point I'm trying to make here is, like, yeah, being that hungry for constant knowledge,
yeah,
feels for, not just constant knowledge, constant input feels very modern.
Yeah, he said apparently he was accustomed to say that no book was so bad as not to contain something useful.
No, that's brilliant. And now that reminds me of two people, one of whom is a mate of ours and one of whom is a dead famous person, and I can't think who it is, but one of our friends, Gavin, who is when we were at university, the European debating champion for his height and fighting weight. And he would eagerly tell me about how he would devour all sorts of different books that you just wouldn't think of be connected. So he read all sorts of books about storytelling and screenwriting. And the biggest one he told me about, he picked up out of a charity shop, was a book all about Baptist preaching. Now, admittedly, it's not that far a journey from preaching to being a public debater, but it's not something that you would immediately go to.
Yeah.
But for him, just every there's something in everything. There's a little grain in every possible book you could read.
It's the origin of Wikipedia, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, the other night I was awake at 2:30 in the morning, not able to sleep, and I thought, I know, I'll read about the declining years of Andropov and Chernenko, just to see what it was like to be a short reigning Russian premier.
Please tell me that Pliny wrote his encyclopedias in blue ink, and that if you touched on the blue ink, it would fast you forward to another part of the encyclopedia.
If only. He also apparently had himself carried from place to place rather than walking, so he could keep reading while he was sitting in his sedan chair. And this may or may not be true, and another version of the story says that he went everywhere with two secretaries, one on one side reading to Pliny, and the other on the other side taking dictation from Pliny.
Now, I first came to know about Pliny the Elder because there is a Goon Show episode entitled The Histories of Pliny the Elder.
That's right, yes.
And that sort of behaviour sounds like it is straight out of a script by Spike Milligan.
Maybe he had a third secretary who was there scripting his everyday antics.
Yes.
Milliganus.
Yeah, yeah, as a Milliganus, very nice. As a comic, I'd love that. Kind of like, one to read to me, one to write down stories that I say, one to just go, oh, that's funny, keep that one.
So, The Natural History is his most famous work, and it's the one that has survived. Pliny and his team of, you know, assistants, they gathered about 20,000 facts, and they had sources from 2,000 volumes by 100 different authors. He, as I think we've mentioned before when we've talked about him, he did attribute all of his facts. He had like a reading list attached to his encyclopedia.
Do you know whether that is something that Pliny himself innovated, or is that still common at the time?
It's not necessarily I don't know if he's the first person to do that, but certainly he was very strong on not plagiarizing and quoting people. I think he wrote about plagiarism, and he was very forthcoming about the fact that he was, you know, he was standing on the shoulders of other literary giants whose work, but again, some of these are works that we would not know existed had Pliny not cited them. There are some very useful descriptions in it. For example, his writings are the only source we have for the use of hushing in mining, which is apparently you flood the mines to help reveal the mineral veins. It sort of washes away dirt and it shows you where the veins for the minerals are. Or the use of water mills for crushing and grinding corn. Again, that was stuff that we wouldn't know about had he not written about it in ancient Rome. It's also pretty much the only work of its time which describes the work of contemporary artists at the time as well. So it's a reference work for future history of art books, because we wouldn't know about the work of various artists, or we wouldn't be able to attribute ancient Roman works of art without Pliny having described the artists and their styles, which is amazing. Some of the things he did describe that are less accurate. He wrote about evil-eyed Illyrians, one-legged monocoli, animal-human hybrids, people with backward-facing feet and 16 toes, people who communicated by barking like dogs. We owe the idea that elephants are scared of mice to Pliny as well. He wrote that elephants hate mice and will refuse to eat fodder that has been touched by one.
Huh.
Isn't that amazing? That's a myth that we believe 2,000 years later, and it's thanks largely to Pliny.
All I can think of there is that there is a direct line from Pliny the Elder to Looney Tunes.
Yeah. On elephants, though, he did say that elephants have knees. Do elephants have knees, Ben?
Yes,
you've seen, everyone's seen elephants bend their legs. Of course they have knees. But for centuries there was a misconception that they didn't have knees, for whatever reason. And Pliny, he gets so much wrong, but on the one instance he actually gets this thing right. He notes that elephants do have knees. He wrote about a snake that can launch itself into the sky to catch high-flying birds. Which I would like to see, frankly.
Surely the way he's thought of that is that they coil themselves up like a spring.
Back to Looney Tunes again, yeah.
Yeah.
He wrote that the tides are caused by the sun and the moon, which is Correct.
One out of two?
Well, pretty much. He certainly didn't say that there were... I think even Galileo said they were because of the movement of planets. He then sort of spoils it a little bit. He says that in Britain, the tides are 80 cubits high. That's 35 metres tall. Which would make Britain a much smaller island, I think, if the tides were 35 metres high.
But would also make us a much more popular surfing destination.
Yeah. I'd say less popular among the residents of Kent.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Maybe Kent would be a much more chilled out and less right-wing place if they all got to hang 10 across Dover and Folkestone Bay.
Maybe so. Yeah, they'd all be catching some radical waves.
Yeah.
Oh, he wrote about mice. He said if you rub mouse poo on your bald head, it can restore your hair.
That is true, mate.
That's Ben's regimen and has been since the age of 18. He says of the octopus, no animal is more savage in causing the death of a man in the water. I mean, the octopuses are terrifying, as I think we've discussed on multiple occasions on this show. He said if you got stung by a scorpion, the way to treat it is to burn the animal and then consume its ashes in a glass of wine. You should brush your teeth with ground mummy.
Because...
The Emperor Colgate recommended it, maybe.
Very good. That, you know what? That is an entirely plausible name for a Roman emperor.
Oh, and he's also... Now, there is another myth that lasted quite a long time. Is the idea that bear cubs are shapeless and have to be licked into shape by their mothers.
Which is where the phrase licked into shape comes from.
Yeah, and that's another Pliny the Elder bequeathal to us. And he wrote about king bees to go alongside queen bees.
Again, that's entirely plausible. I don't know what the king bees do. They can only move one hexagon at a time inside the hive.
That or they were, you know, quite successful singer-songwriters. I was going for B.B. King.
Oh, B.B. King's not a singer-songwriter. He's a blues guitarist.
Well, he wrote and sang songs.
No, he wrote and sang songs, but singer-songwriters make him sound like James Taylor or Ed Sheeran or Katie Tunstall.
That's just your white-tinted glasses, Ben.
Don't goad me, you prick.
We've discussed that Ben has a master's? No, you wrote a dissertation in music theory of some sort?
I wrote a dissertation on the... impact of the American blues on British popular culture in the 1950s and 60s, and I will wield it given any chance.
Death by a thousand paper cuts. Yeah. Oh, he gave us the phrase fortune favours the brave.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently he did. His nephew, again, writing about Pliny's death, says that he uttered the words fortune favours the brave just before he died. Which happened during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, which we'll talk about very shortly.
You just reminded me of a fact I learned today that has nothing to do with Pliny the Elder, but considering how much eclecticism he enjoyed, you'll like this. I read today about Adam Faith, the singer. He sadly passed away on the 8th of March 2003. His last words were reportedly... Channel 5 is all shit, isn't it? Christ, the crap they put on there. It's a waste of space. And then he died.
Please tell me Channel 5 ran an obituary to Adam Faith.
Yeah, it said, Christ, Adam Faith is shit, isn't he? The crap he puts on there. He's a waste of space. R.I.P. Our thoughts are with his family at this difficult time.
He noted that it has been observed that the height of a man from the crown of the head to the sole of the foot is equal to the distance between the tip of the middle fingers of the two hands. So basically the Vitruvian man.
Oh, so he basically scooped Leonardo da Vinci by a good 1500 years.
Yes. If you wanted to have thick hair, again, Ben, maybe this is another way you've got it. You might be applying the urine of a young ass to achieve your current hirsute state. If you had epilepsy, you should consider using a camel's brain dried and taken in vinegar.
No,
you should consider it, though.
I will consider it, and having considered it, I refuse to do it.
If you are suffering from a low libido, he suggests one of two solutions. The right section of a vulture's lung worn as an amulet in a crane's skin is a powerful aphrodisiac.
See, this is the Pliny the Elder content to come here for. That's so specific. Obviously, the scientific method didn't exist then, but did he try like an ibis's spleen halved and worn as a bracelet?
The lucky thing for Pliny is he's the encyclopedia compiler, so someone else has had to go through all of these experiments and come to him, and that, like, maybe he's also he probably had a team of assistants, so they're coming to him going, okay, we've compiled various different solutions for what you do if you've got a low libido, from various different writings, you know, from North Africa and from Persia and from across Europe. And Pliny goes, okay, now you all have to go test these out and come back to me with your results.
Oh no, they're testing them as they walk alongside his sedan chair.
Yeah. Do you feel horny now you're wearing the vulture's lung in the crane skin? No, next up it's the ostrich heart in the lugworm.
I love the idea of an experiment. Do you, it's sort of like an optician. Do you feel horny now? How about now?
He also suggested, as an alternative, consume the yolks of 5 dove eggs mixed with a denarius of pig fat and honey. And he said, as a last resort, you could also wear, as an amulet, a rooster's right testicle wrapped in a ram skin. So that's a vulture's lung in a crane skin, or a rooster's right testicle in a ram skin. Don't get them mixed up. You don't want the rooster rice testicle in the crane skin.
Yeah, what happens if you wear that?
Oh, your penis, like, retracts forever, presumably. It's like crossing the streams. If you have toothache, you should eat mouse twice a month. A mouse twice a month keeps the toothache away. And if you have joint pain, you should bathe in the urine of a person who's been living on a cabbage diet.
Ooh.
That's a battery farm you don't want to visit.
The cabbage urine battery farms of Bavaria. Just overweight German men all called Klaus chomping away on sauerkraut and pissing into flasks.
But yes, I say he died in AD 79 during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius.
Now, two things. One, did he write about it? And two, does that
he wasn't that quick. It was literally during the... Like, he didn't have time to send a tweet saying, I'm at Pompeii, smoke pretty thick now, we'll write more soon. / thread. Did he write about it?
Well, you never know. He seems like a very hard-working, committed guy. Maybe he was like, I'm gonna die. People are going to want to know what was going on, so this is what I bequeath to future generations.
There are various interpretations of what happened when he died. He was across the Bay of Naples when the eruption started, and the eruption had already destroyed Pompeii and Herculaneum. And he had crossed the bay to Stabiae, which is another town near Vesuvius, because he
is a French town with a high knife crime problem.
He was there. He wanted to rescue particularly a friend and family, but he brought a fleet of ships with him, apparently, and certainly his fleet managed to save probably about 2,000 refugees from the eruption, according to modern studies. But basically, he got there to the shores below Vesuvius. It's not entirely sure whether he was trying to just conduct the rescue and couldn't find his friend, and he was overcome by the fumes. The suggestion is he was very overweight and suffered from asthma, so it may have been that he wasn't able to deal with them as much as his companions were. Other people suggest he just had a heart attack, again, probably not aided by the toxicity of the fumes. He either was there trying to find his friend, or he got a little bit too scientifically interested in witnessing what was happening around him.
Right? I was right.
He was there on the shores of the town at Stabiae, and his men had to leave his body there. His body was never found. He was a quite respected figure, so that'll tell you about just how dangerous it was that he was sailing this boat into the jaws of the eruption. And apparently he took a quicker ship to get ahead of the fleet so he could get there quicker, because he was looking for this friend of his. Various witnesses told Pliny the Younger about what had happened, and so we have the recounting of his death from Pliny the Younger then writing to other people and telling them about it. Apparently, though, his skull may have been found.
Go on.
So this skull was found about a century ago. It was found on the shores at the beach at Stabiae as part of a body which had a very ornamented short sword and had golden necklaces and bracelets. It was one of about 70 skeletons that were all buried together shortly after the Vesuvius eruption. And so this one particularly seemed like quite a promising candidate, because it was a high-ranking Roman naval officer who seemed like he'd sailed to the shores during the eruption. And at the time, the guy who discovered it, he suggested, this guy was called Gennaro Matrone, he suggested might be Pliny, but he didn't have any additional info. And so he sold most of the artifacts and the bones to various different buyers, but he donated the skull and a jawbone to Rome's Museum of the History of the Art of Medicine. And a few years ago, researchers led by a guy called Flavio Russo used some modern DNA sequencing to test the theory, and they suggest, obviously they can't, you know, conclusively go back 2,000 years and say this is definitely Pliny the Elder, but according to the Times' article on it, the DNA and the overall shape fit Pliny's profile. He's a man who could trace some of his lineage to Italy, and he likely died in his 40s or 50s. Although the jawbone is not part of the same skull. The jawbone is from a North African, so possibly a slave, or certainly someone of non-Italian descent who was there with them.
I thought you were suggesting that Pliny the Elder had had a jaw transplant from an African slave.
From dictating too much.
Yes,
it overuse of the jaw. So we may well have found that article was a couple of years ago. So we may well have found the skull of Pliny the Elder about 2,000 years at last after he perished at Pompeii. Oh,
good Lord. I mean, you weren't expecting when you tuned in, friends, a radio episode of Indiana Jones.
I'm sure we will not have heard the last of Pliny the Elder. It will continue to pop up on episodes of the show.
We've not heard the last of you, Pliny the Elder.
He's definitely one of our favourite recurring characters. It should now be at the point that audiences give like a round of applause when he walks in like a favourite sitcom character.
Yeah. Well, he's basically the Fonz of this podcast. He just lives above the toilets of Worst Foot Forward's favourite bar and comes down and occasionally hits the jukebox with a goat testicle wrapped in Parma ham, gets it working again, and then goes back upstairs.
Of course, Pliny the Elder did write that it was possible to jet ski over a shark. It was very common in Cyprus, I think, in the early part of the first millennium.
I mean, after this, I really want to do a Latin version of the Happy Days theme tune.
I'm not joking, actually. You did genuinely write that about a boy who rode to and from school on a dolphin's back, so maybe he was closer to the Fonz than we realised.
Don't be ridiculous. For real?
Yeah, I did.
This is the greatest discovery about him so far.
Dies Lune, Dies Martes.
I knew it. I knew that's what you were Google translating.
Dies Mercury, Dies Jovis, Dies Veneris, Dies Saturni, Dies Solis. Dies Laetie, I think, is happy. And genuinely, listeners, this is where you're going to come into your own. One of you has got to send us. One of you must be musically talented and bored enough to make us the Latin version of Happy Days in tribute to Pliny, the Fonz, the Elder.
Yeah, if you do that, like, enormous props and shout out on the show. We might even replace our theme tune with that.
There's your, and just before lockdown comes to an end, there's a bit of, homework for everybody.
It's all right, there'll be another lockdown along soon.
We might actually read the entirety of the natural history then.
Yeah.
So thank you all very much for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Thank you especially to our Patreon donors whose contributions to the show help pay for these extra episodes. If you want to join them in supporting the show, then you can visit patreon.com/worstfootforward, and where you can find the various different tiers at which you can support us and the various rewards you would get if you were to do so. And we are ever closer to 50 donors on Patreon, at which point Ben and I will have to pull up our trousers, I was about to say. It's very hot today, so it wouldn't be surprising if we were both bottomless. We'll have to put our thinking caps on and get our act together and start putting together a Worst Foot Forward book when we hit 50 donors. So if you want to force us into a life of servitude, then where we might contribute a book as learned and as full of facts as Pliny's Natural History, then please do that. You can also, as ever, find us on Twitter on @WorstFoot, on Facebook if you look up Worst Foot Forward, and you can email us on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com if you want to get in touch, which a few of you have been doing lately, so thank you for that. Anything else?
No, I have nothing else to add. I am off to bathe a goose in semi-skimmed milk whilst placing a single glacé cherry on the end of its beak in order to cure coronavirus.
Got as good a chance as anything these days.
Yep.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye-bye.